presentation is about the evolution of the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene's program to reduce teen pregnancy in the South Bronx. The presentation is going to consist of three main parts. First, a brief background information on teen pregnancy in the South Bronx. Second, a description of our programmatic efforts, including our strategic planning process. And third, our evaluation and research findings. Over the past decade, New York City's teen pregnancy rate has been on the decline, but you can see a large gap that persists between the boroughs of the Bronx and the other four boroughs. In addition, despite these declines, New York City's overall rate is still higher than the U.S. average. And in certain parts of the city, the rates are truly alarming. Every year, approximately 15% of 15 to 19-year-old girls living in the South Bronx get pregnant. And this is evidence of one of many health disparities that differentiate the South Bronx from the rest of New York City. It was in response to these health disparities that the New York City Department of Health created three district public health offices, or DPHOs, 4 years ago. These offices in the South Bronx, East and Central Harlem, and North and Central Brooklyn are located where the health disparities are the greatest and not surprisingly intersect with the poorest areas in New York City. When the South Bronx DPHO opened, our premier charge was to tackle the teen pregnancy rate. We decided to begin our intervention around the public high schools because we knew there was a mandate within our sister agency, the Department of Education, that required schools to establish a condom availability program. Each high school is mandated to have a health resource room where students can get free condoms and health information. In 2003, our assessment in the South Bronx was that half of the public high schools were not compliant with the mandate. So we began to place community health workers into these schools, into the health resource rooms. As we all know, promoting condom use is not enough to lower the teen pregnancy rate. So in 2005, we embarked on creating a strategic plan to expand our effort. I'm going to breeze through some of this because you can pick up a copy at the end of our talk. So our strategic planning process, though, was guided by three key principles. First, we wanted to make sure that whatever programs we implemented took into account the context of the South Bronx, its resources, its strengths, and its size. Whatever we implemented had to be able to be scaled up to reach the entire South Bronx with our current resources, both staff and budget. Second, we wanted to explore the published literature and speak with experts and community members to make sure that our programmatic efforts were built on solid evidence. And third, we wanted to identify and focus on areas where the health department has the greatest potential for impact. The schools continued to be a promising intervention point, but where else could we make a difference? The initial phase of our strategic planning process lasted approximately 3 months and started with looking at the specific context of the South Bronx. The local epidemiology showed that in addition to having the high teen pregnancy rate, there was a high abortion rate, over 60%, countering some anecdotal evidence that many teens want to get pregnant. We also saw from the 2005 Youth Risk Behavior Survey, which in New York City is conducted in public high schools, that we had relatively high rates of condom use, but very low rates of reported hormonal method use. Since hormonal method use requires a teen to see a doctor, we began to consider the medical community as another intervention point. And we also started to think about the messages that teens are receiving as an intervention point, because the message to use condoms that arose out of the AIDS epidemic has been very clear and consistent in New York City and seems to have had a positive impact on teen behavior. A clear and consistent message about hormonal method use, or dual use, on the other hand, is not being sent. To further understand the local context, we conducted a market analysis. We talked to over 40 local community-based organizations and clinics, and we found many potential partners with an interest in reducing teen pregnancy, but it wasn't their main interest. We also found very few high schools in the South Bronx had school-based health centers, and that while there were many health services available in the South Bronx, services weren't provided in teen-accessible ways. In the published literature, we saw a common element in many programs that reduce sexual risk-taking is having a trusted, caring adult who forms a relationship with a teen over time, time to send those consistent messages. And one such program was school-linked healthcare, which I'll discuss further, But for now, it's important to note that it combined two of the intervention points we were considering, schools and the medical community, and that there was evidence that it reduced the teen pregnancy rate by upwards of 30%. Finally, our consultation with local and national experts was critical in helping guide our findings. Our national experts included Dr. Soap Kirby and John Santelli, and our local experts included our Youth Advisory Board, which is a group of teenagers who volunteer with the DPHO and with whom we confer when we need to understand an issue from a teenage point of view. So after this initial phase, we drafted our plan, we sent it for comment both within the health department and to our market analysis contacts and the local and national experts, and then we revised, finalized, and resent the plan. You'll see that the plan meets our guiding principles, including being able to be scaled up to the South Bronx with our current resources. And the plan consists of five components that center around three intervention points: the schools, the medical community, and then the public health message received by teens and the adults in their lives. Now for each component of the strategic plan, one by one. So one, create school-linked healthcare. School-linked healthcare connects students sexual and reproductive health services through staff that is available to students in both school and a nearby clinic. This map shows what our starting point was in the South Bronx. The high schools we were in are in blue, and the small green squares are the 93 medical practices that see teens. Our vision was that our staff in the high school health resource room would also be stationed in local clinics one afternoon a week, enabling them to make a very personal referrals for students. So if a student walked into Victor's health resource room, Victor's one of our community health workers, the student walked in for condoms or with a pregnancy scare and STD concern, he could say to them, you know, here's information, here's a list of clinics, but I'll actually be at clinic A. Why don't you come by? I can help you. And if the student comes by, Victor can help them navigate. And if not, when student sees the student again, he can follow up to see if they made it to a clinic, and he can resend the message to get sexual and reproductive health care and that he is at the linked clinic to help. So in our model of school linked health care, it's slightly different than the model program, because in the model program, the program actually runs the clinic, but our health department doesn't run clinics that have contraceptive services, so we had to seek out external partners. The criteria we set for these partners were, as listed there, providing basic sexual and reproductive health services, including prescribing hormonal contraception and STD testing and treatment, dispensing some contraception on site or through a nearby pharmacy, at a minimum, condoms, birth control pills, Depo-Provera, and emergency contraception, providing these services and contraception regardless of the teen's ability to pay, providing them without parental consent as protected by New York State law, and in gray, teen-friendly. This criteria really became willingness to work on teen-friendliness, and you'll see why when Philip presents our research findings. While we thought the geographic location was actually going to be important, we learned that the teens will travel for a school-linked healthcare site. We initially targeted four clinics, which are the red stars on the map, and in 2006-2007 school year, we were able to launch with two of them. We had four staff linking eight high schools, covering about 25% of our student body. And this year we've launched two additional clinics, are linking 15 schools, covering about 34% of our student body. And we have two to five more clinics in the works. So what else does school-linked healthcare take? The green and bold items here are the basic elements of school-linked healthcare. And in white are things that are more specific to our model. Of note, even the clinics that met our criteria needed systems improvement, and this was a perfect fit with our agency's new Healthy Teens initiative, which provides a toolkit on seven steps to comprehensive sexual and reproductive health care for adolescents in New York City, and that's available online. And then for partners, clinics that join on as partners with the Healthy Teens initiative, it also provides training and technical assistance. We also discovered that there was a sea of medical practices in the South Bronx, those 93 practices. We found that we needed to create a marketing material to help teens and adults in their lives find our school-linked healthcare partners and other practices that meet our criteria. And this is our marketing material. 12 of the 93 practices made our guide. Some medical practices also made changes to actually meet our criteria to either be part of school and childcare or to be in this guide. 3 of them clarified or systematized their ability to provide services regardless of the team's ability to pay. 3 decided to have contraception on site, and 4 others are actively working on these issues. So these efforts have not only linked teams to care under our first component, they have also improved adolescent health care in the South Bronx, which is the second component of our strategic plan. So component number 2, improve adolescent health care. Our local experts told us that the barriers teens face in accessing care actually start at the front line. So we decided to start there. We investigated with a mystery shopper survey Philip will tell you about and developed a training for front desk staff called Help Teens. It focuses on minors' rights to confidentiality and greeting teens and features this teen help card, which is also up on the screen, which participants customize during the training to match the practice's policies. They role play, and it is then kept at their desk to remind them to tell teens the information they need to know when seeking sexual and reproductive health services. The help teens training also encourages practices that don't provide care in a teen-accessible way to offer referrals to clinics in our guide. 3, create and communicate a clear public health message. This focuses on our third intervention point, message received by teens and the adults in their lives. In order to have a clear message, we saw that we needed to combine our teen pregnancy and HIV and STI prevention forces, and we realized that we had to do that to begin with internally. We have 4 Department of Health offices concerned with teen sexual activity, so this was no easy task. We have the Bureau of Maternal, Infant, and Reproductive Health, a separate Bureau of STD, yet a separate Bureau of HIV, and also an Office of School Health. So even before creating a message for the public, we really had to step back and decide what our stand was as an agency. And only recently are we armed with this unified stand on the screen that our agency messages around teen sexual health should include the following. That choosing not to have sex is the surest way for teens to prevent pregnancy and STIs, and that sexually active teens should use condoms and another form of birth control, that is a long-acting form, to prevent both pregnancy and sexually transmitted infections. From our strategic planning process, we know that there is some support for this stand in the South Bronx, that there is some concern over hormonal methods. Our next steps are to include formulating messages for teens based on this stand and determining the best way to foster a unified message within the community of the South Bronx. Our fourth component is to align teen pregnancy prevention with other New York City priority issues as another way of working to impact the message that is received by teens and the adults in their lives. We've had great success in the areas that are displayed. New York City's mayor's priorities include high school dropout and economic development, and we successfully pitched teen pregnancy prevention as a key strategy to address these issues. Results have included service learning programs being funded through our city's Department of Youth and Community Development. We're also working with our New York City Department of Education to pilot an evidence-based sex education curriculum at a few middle and high schools in the Bronx. And this is also happening in the context of New York State recently joining a number of states that have rejected federal funds for abstinence-only until marriage programs because of their failure to demonstrate effectiveness in delaying teen sex and because they've shown to have often contain medical inaccuracies. And lastly, recognizing that teen mothers have higher rates of infant mortality, City Council infant mortality reduction funds have been earmarked for teen pregnancy prevention efforts. Our fifth and final component is to conduct local research to improve programs. We wanted to learn more about what was going on locally, and the first area we delved into was the healthcare environment for teens seeking sexual and reproductive health care. Philip is going to talk about our evaluation findings and then this research.
So first I'm going to talk about the ways that we evaluate our school-based teen pregnancy prevention program. We evaluate these programs by tracking the number of condoms we distribute, as well as the number of successful school and healthcare referrals made to our clinic partners, and also also by collecting data directly from our clinic partners. But first up, condoms. Going the wrong way. There we go. We track the number of condoms that we distribute at the 17 schools, at which we have a Department of Health staff member manning the health resource room. And you can see that every quarter and every year, we hand out more and more condoms, which is great. However, as an evaluator, I always want to have a concrete goal or target. So the question becomes, how many condoms should we distribute to protect our sexually active teens? I won't go through the entire metric and its derivation today. If you're interested, I'll be presenting on this topic tomorrow. It's a little shameless self-promotion. But based on statistics such as the proportion of sexually active teens, the probability of condom use at last sex, and the frequency of sex, we've estimated that to cover all sex acts between South Bronx teens at our 17 schools, we need to distribute a little over 100,000 condoms per year, whereas to cover the sex between teens who claim to have used a condom at last sex, and according to the YRBS, that was 68%, we'd need to hand out 71,000 condoms or so. So last school year, we achieved 51% of the 100% target and 75% of our 68% target. So now for schooling to healthcare. Teens referred to a clinic partner are given a raffle ticket that they drop in a plastic safe at the clinic front desk. It's our tracking method. It's very high-tech. And this graph shows that since the inception of the program, half of students referred to a linked clinic have actually shown up. We also asked for at least 2 years of baseline clinic data, data about the number of teen patients and teen visits for pregnancy tests or contraceptive issues, so we could see if there was an increase in those kind of visits post-linkage, and there was. So these data are for one of our clinic partners and the number of teens seen for pregnancy tests, as well as the number of teens for contraception, have reached levels not seen in the 2 years leading up to the intervention. And again, that's a great indicator of schooling healthcare's potential success. So point number 5 in the strategic plan was to conduct local research. Currently, this research aims to understand the South Bronx clinic environment and the ways in which it helps or hinders teens' access to sexual and reproductive healthcare, which relates perfectly to point number 2 on the plan. And to that end, we've thus far conducted 3 research projects, and I'll present the highlights of results from all 3. The first was a highly structured series of 2 phone calls each to all of our 93 clinics where teens can be seen in our area. One round of calls was made by a college intern, and the other by teenage members of the DPHO's Youth Advisory Board that Alina mentioned before. Callers pose as a 15-year-old girl seeking birth control pills, and the purpose was to investigate how teen-friendly the frontline phone staff at these clinics were, as we believe that it's not only the doctor-patient interaction that's important for making a teen feel relaxed and comfortable, but also that first contact with the clinic staff member. So we conceptualize teen friendliness as consisting of 2 facets. First is disclosure, which addresses whether the frontline staff discussed issues of confidentiality, parental involvement, and payment method. And secondly, our come-across scale, which is really just general customer service. Were they friendly, comforting, and knowledgeable? So, first, did staff at our 93 clinics disclose information that we at the Department of Health feel is most important for teens to know? No. And this and subsequent graphs, red equals bad and blue equals good, and that black vertical line is the scale midpoint, almost half of phone calls made resulted in no information about parental involvement or payment being disclosed. Next, how is the frontline staff's general customer service? Well, better than their disclosure, but still 50-50, with 36% of calls resulting in unfavorable ratings and 44% in positive ones. Finally, we also asked callers if, based on that one phone call alone, they would seek care for themselves at that clinic, and it shouldn't come as any surprise that the majority said they would not. So you can see the import of the frontline staff training that Alina had discussed. We want to be sure that when an adolescent contacts a clinic, in person or on the phone, that staff person can discuss minors' rights to sexual and reproductive health care in a knowledgeable and comforting way. Next, we conducted a phone survey with the self-identified site administrators at all 93 of our area clinics to investigate the existence of a formal policy in regards to prescribing hormonal methods to teens, and if such a policy existed, what was required. Guidelines that appeared in JAMA in 2001 clearly state that for a woman who's been sexually active for fewer than 3 years, a pelvic exam is not indicated. We wanted to see if current clinic policy reflected current medical best practices. So first, roughly 60% of the 68 clinics we were able to contact stated they had a formal or an informal policy. And of the 39 clinics that did have a policy, here's the breakdown of what those policies contained. So more than 60% of the policies required a breast exam. medically unnecessary. And almost 60% required a pelvic exam. Again, medically unnecessary, and it's pretty clear how a pelvic exam might erect a barrier for a teenage girl trying to get hormonal birth control. So helping our clinics get up to speed with current best practices is another place where we believe the Department of Health can affect positive change and improve adolescent health care. So far, we've seen that clinic frontline staff may hinder teen access to reproductive health care by failing to disclose pertinent information in a teen-friendly way. And you've also seen that clinic policy might erect barriers to the receipt of hormonal contraception. We were also interested in assessing whether provider beliefs and practices contributed to the low OC use among teens in our community. So we conducted a male survey of all providers that we could identify in our area. And I stressed providers we could identify because it proved unbelievably difficult to obtain a valid, up-to-date list of doctors and nurse practitioners in our catchment area. It was an important lesson for me to learn just how difficult it was to obtain this kind of information. While it is possible that it's a South Bronx-specific problem, we do have a really high turnover rate. Part of me fears that it might be more widespread. But the site administrators that we had contacted for the previous research pretty much refused to give the names of their doctors, so we couldn't get their addresses that way. We did obtain lists from two of the three main managed care plans that are most likely to service our area, and those lists were horribly outdated. And we also had doctor names and addresses from other Department of Health programs, and while we ended up mailing 450 surveys, our best guess, and it really is just an educated guess, is that there are 314 unique providers who see teens for sexual and reproductive health care in the South Bronx. Most survey providers prescribe oral contraception, and fewer than half prescribe the ring. 10% of surveyed providers that do see teens didn't prescribe any method of hormonal birth control, whereas 35% prescribed all four. And the number of methods prescribed was positively correlated with the proportion of teens seen in that practice. So the more teens there were in the practice, the more methods you were likely to prescribe. We think that certain provider behaviors facilitate the receipt of reproductive health care for teens, behaviors like asking parents to leave the exam room, initiating discussions about contraception, etc. And while the vast majority of providers engage teens in these ways during routine physicals, fewer than half took advantage of the opportunity provided them during sick visits. Now, this might be a good place to intervene in order to encourage doctors to talk about reproductive health with adolescents whenever they can. Overall, the survey doctors were more concerned about teens using the patch and depo than they were about birth control pills or the ring, but it's important to note that the concerns specific to each method varied. So while docs were primarily worried about teens missing doses of the pill, they were most concerned about the deleterious side effects of Depo-Provera. Provider education could focus on and mitigate these method-specific concerns in order to increase prescriptions written and subsequent teen utilization. We also asked providers about the existence of written policies or unwritten protocols when it comes to prescribing hormonal birth control methods to teens. We did this as a check of the site administrator survey, and while some of the individual percents are pretty different, 40% versus 56% for a pelvic exam requirement, the general pattern is the same. And when we asked doctors to list what tests they actually conduct prior to prescribing birth control to teens, 58% require that a teen who's been sexually active for fewer than 3 years have to have a pelvic exam, and 46% require a breast exam. Neither of these practices are medically necessary for a teen who's been sexually active for fewer than 3 years. So in summary, the strategic planning process led to an actionable plan. Our deep understanding of the context of the South Bronx and our own agency's resources and limitations have been critical to the program's success. Our local research has further contributed to our understanding of the context of the South Bronx. It supported our decision to train frontline staff, and it's also identified our next steps for improving adolescent healthcare, which could include to educate clinic administrators and practitioners about best practices guidelines, to address provider fears about prescribing hormonal contraception to teens, to possibly encourage them to discuss contraception with teens during sick visits as well as physicals. We'll continue with each of our 5 plan components in the South Bronx, look for opportunities to bring our lessons learned to other parts of New York City, and we look forward to measuring our neighborhood-based public health program to reduce teen pregnancy disparities in New York City by the true measure, which is the precipitous fall of the teen pregnancy rate in the South Bronx. Thank you.
Um, try and have both a male and female in the school and in the clinic if possible, which it isn't always. I mentioned that we do not have a lot of school-based health centers that are actually in the schools in New York City overall in the high school level. There is an effort within New York City to increase the number of school-based health centers, and through that process, with the mayor's priorities around high school dropout and economic development, in addition to funding service learning, there has been some extra funding put towards school-based health centers, and I believe it's five or six. They're working on five or six, but that still gives us, we're still really short of covering all the high schools in New York City. Collect this data, including 2 years of back data. We wanted